The first case for this morning is United States v. John Burge. Mr. Martin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The name John Burge is probably a name that's not unfamiliar to the Court. Certainly it's not a name that was unfamiliar to government investigators, or in the late 1980s and the early 1990s, the government initiated a series of investigations of Mr. Burge and, in each instance, declined prosecution. It was not until October of 2008 that Mr. Burge was indicted. This was about 23 years after the last allegation of abuse at the Area 2 police station, 16 years after he had been separated from the Chicago Police Department, and it was after plaintiff's lawyers who had filed lawsuits against Mr. Burge had lobbied the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Chicago to investigate Burge after a special prosecutor had declined prosecution for statute of limitations reasons. The first in the underlying civil case that was at issue in the indictment was a case which occurred at the Area 2 police station after Mr. Burge was even assigned to Area 2. He became a commander in August of 1986, and the interrogation of Madison Hobley occurred in January of 1987. It was not alleged that Mr. Burge had any connection to Madison Hobley's interrogation. It was not alleged that he questioned him or physically abused him or had any interactions with him. The first issue which I'd like to discuss today is the issue surrounding the official proceedings element of the obstruction of justice charges.
Are we going to talk about Dunn, the case, U.S. versus Dunn?
Yes.
Okay. Then I have a question for you.
Sure. You want me to talk about it now?
Well, here's the thing. You compare the criminal offense in counts 1 and 3 with the crime in 18 U.S.C. Section 1623 that was addressed in Dunn. But here's my problem. That statute addresses very different language. Section 1623 criminalizes false declarations made under oath in official proceedings, whereas Section 1512 addresses conduct that attempts to influence or impede an official proceeding. Isn't it clear that under Section 1512, it does not matter whether the conduct occurs in the proceeding or elsewhere if it was an attempt to impede an official proceeding? In fact, the conduct in 1512C1 involving destruction of evidence would be extremely unlikely to occur in the proceeding itself. And that's my problem.
Okay.
With your argument.
I think there's
which a... Which had me coming and going for a while, I have to tell you.
I think there's about three questions in your Honor's question, and I'm going to try and take them, and hopefully I'll cover each one. First of all, with respect to statutory language, we would respectfully submit that the statutory language in 1623 and the statutory language in 1515
1515
is the statute that
defines
official proceedings. It's almost identical in that both statutes use the word before. Now before is a word of importance. It has to mean something. Every word in the statute should be given meaning. Now, if you take 1512 and you lay out that statute and you insert the definition of official proceeding as defined in 1515, the statute, in our opinion, pretty clearly requires that the obstructive conduct occur before a court or judge of the United States. And in Dunn, the done expressly considered the meaning of the word proceedings, that it has to be some kind of formal proceeding. It's not enough that it was ancillary to the court or was somehow connected to a proceeding. Indeed, there was a proceeding in Dunn, that being the grand jury proceeding and the criminal case for which the defendant there was ultimately charged, for which he recanted. So you have to focus on the word before, and you have to focus on the word proceeding. Now, I understand Your Honor's point about the attempt, but the fact of the matter is here, if you look at all the evidence, there's no evidence that Mr. Burge attempted to do anything before a court. He didn't come into court and was about to do something and was stopped for some reason. I mean, that's the classic intent attempt. The government called two of his lawyers, Mr. Sotos and Mr. Condon. They didn't testify that, hey, we advised Mr. Burge that these answers potentially could be used in court. There was no testimony of that sort. The plaintiff's lawyer, Mr. Lovey, testified, and he testified that he received the answers and he put them in his file. He didn't do anything with them. He said he treated them as admissions, and then when pressed on it, he said, well, that's really a legal conclusion. They were just denials, and it's undisputed that they were not filed or used or attempted to be filed or attempted to be used.
But isn't it clear that an official proceeding was foreseeable in this case? I mean, these interrogatory statements were given in direct preparation for the pending civil trial. And the statute talks about the fact that the proceeding need not even be pending.
I understand that provision in the statute, and that it was not the situation in this case. In this case, we can see there was an official proceeding pending. The question is whether Mr. Burge took actions before the court or the judge as required by the statute. So that statutory provision is a red herring because it didn't apply. That is meant to encompass situations like the Fowler case that was before the United States Supreme Court. In that case, the defendant shot and killed a law enforcement officer before there was any attempt to communicate what the defendant may have been doing to federal authorities.
So it's pretty broad, you know. The government's just got to prove that the defendant's allegedly obstructive conduct had a relationship in time, causation, logic with the official proceedings. That's really broad.
That is broad, but we still have to go back to the language of the statute. It requires an action before the court. One thing I would note about the provision.
You know, the endeavor had to have a natural, probable effect of interfering with the official proceeding. And
just to get back to the statute that Judge Williams cited, one thing that's interesting about all this was the 1512 came into effect in 1982 under an act which was designed to protect witnesses and victims of crimes. And the reasonable foreseeability of a proceeding provision was in there at that time. But what was not in there at that time was subsection C, under which Mr. Burge was charged. That didn't come into being until 2002 as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and it was a response, of course, to the Enron scandal. So it's a situation where they're inserting a new statute with definitions that were there previously, and you have to look at each particular provision and see how it fits. And Your Honor mentioned destruction of evidence, and I understand the government's arguments. Oh, my gosh, if Mr. Burge's position were accepted, then we couldn't prosecute these cases, like the Matthews case where the defendant was a police officer and he got rid of a gun. But the point is the Matthews case was a C-1 case, and C-1 expressly addresses making evidence unavailable for official proceeding. And what's important about the C1 provision is if you were to accept Mr. Burge's argument, it would not be a situation where we can't prosecute obstruction if it didn't occur in court. Because if you look at C1, that statute uses the word availability. The defendant has to do something to make it unavailable for court.
Well, look, you've got C1, and then you have C2, which directly relates to C1, because C2 includes other ways in which a person may attempt to impede the official proceeding.
It may be construed that way as a whole, but Mr. Burge was just charged with C2. The indictment only charged C2. The jury instructions only sounded in C2. There was no charge brought under C1 in this case. And my point is that you have to look at that statute, the words of that statute, and it requires the action occur before a judge or court, as in Dunn. And here the defendant didn't attempt to do anything before a judge or court, and nobody testified that they even advised him that these answers, one of which was not even under oath, could be used in a court proceeding.
Maybe you should go on to the
I will. Thank you, Your Honor. The next argument I'd like to address is the constructive amendment argument with respect to the perjury charge. The indictment in this case alleged that Mr. Burge's interrogatory answers were material to Hobley's outcome, period. It did not make materiality dependent on anything else. And by that, I mean it did not make materiality dependent upon evidence discovery or decisions of counsels or civil discovery process. It just said the outcome of Hobley's case was the material component that was affected. Now, at the original jury instruction conference, we agreed with the government that this court's pattern instruction on materiality should be given. And that was fine, and we thought that was going to be the instruction that was given. And then on the last jury instruction conference, just before the closing arguments, the government revised it and submitted a new instruction. And this instruction was not the court's pattern instruction and came up with a new definition of materiality. And the instruction, of course, is included in the record and quoted in the briefs. But what it did was it made more than the outcome of Hobley the relevant decision for materiality purposes. Mr. Burge objected to this instruction, and the court tinkered with the language a bit, but added this extra materiality element in that. Now, what was material was not just the outcome of the Hobley case, but anything that could be reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of evidence admissible at trial. That formulation was different from what was in the indictment. It added to the possible basis for conviction with respect to materiality. It made materiality synonymous with relevancy, which materiality is something different than relevancy. And it gave the jury another ground to convict because the instruction sounded in the disjunctive. It used the word or, so the jury could convict Mr. Burge if they thought these interrogatories could lead to the discovery of evidence or if they affected the outcome of Mr. Hobley's case. So you have one standard in the indictment, two standards in the instructions, and that, in our opinion, is a classic constructive amendment. In Styrone versus the United States, of course, the United States Supreme Court held that a constructive amendment could never be considered as harmless error and that it is per se reversible error. And this case, in a series of cases, all of which are quoted in our brief, has followed that principle espoused in Styrone. It's interesting because on appeal, the government does not ask that Styrone be reexamined in light of later developments. It does not ask that this court overrule its prior cases. And I understand that there's a question out there in the law as to whether constructive amendments are still not subject to the harmless error test. Because when the Supreme Court has listed all the things that are structural error, they haven't included the Styrone case in their listing. But to this day, it hasn't been overruled, and until that day comes, if there is a constructive amendment, it is reversible error under the law as it presently stands. If there are no further questions on that issue, then I would turn to the exclusion of the prior testimony. What we're talking about here is the exclusion of the testimony of Detectives Eusitis, O'Hara, and Hill. There's always a problem when a government brings a case that's based on 25, 20, 30-year-old allegations, and that is that witnesses die, witnesses become infirm, and that's what happened in this case. Detectives Eusitis, Hill, O'Hara, who were direct movers and shakers of the events of February 14th, 1982, had all passed away.
But, you know, you honestly and properly acknowledge that at least some of the prior cross-examined testimony did not fall within the hearsay exception in 8041 because the United States wasn't a party in the prior proceeding. And so, you know, they didn't have an opportunity to cross-examine these witnesses. And I know that you also argue that the cross-examination was done by those who had the same motive to praise their statements. But, you know, as an old district court judge, I don't think that a district court judge is in any position to make that determination. I mean, I don't think that we would want to create a situation in which we are determining whether the motives to cross-examine are similar in two proceedings that involve different parties. You know, we're talking about mini trials there.
Well, it's interesting, Your Honor, because when the government sought to introduce the testimony of Andrew Wilson, we raised that argument that the motives were different because it was not a criminal proceeding. The criminal proceeding at that time was not foreseeable. Mr. Wilson took the Fifth Amendment, so we couldn't fully explore what he had to say. And the government quickly poo-pooed that argument and said, wait a second, it was one issue in this case, and that's the credibility of Mr. Wilson's allegations versus the credibility of the police officer's allegations. And the district court agreed with him, and we haven't challenged that ruling on appeal. So I think in the context of this record, you can say that the motive was the same. And the problem we have with the district court's ruling is really twofold. One is that the court took it for itself to judge the reliability or the credibility of the officer's statements, which were directly relevant to what Mr. Wilson had testified to. And it's our position that really should have been for the jury to sort out. And I think after Perry versus New Hampshire, it's pretty clear that the preference is for juries to sort out credibility disputes. The second issue is that you can't ignore the context of this case, and there really was a lack of parity here. The government was allowed to introduce Andrew Wilson's testimony. He testified at length, and he was, according to the prior transcripts, barking and making gestures, and none of that could be replicated. The government brought in a clean-cut FBI agent who just simply read the words. So we were at a disadvantage, and the one way to put us on a level playing field is let the jury hear everything that was testified to, everything that was cross-examined. It's not as if this were some a dubious secondhand hearsay report. It was transcribed. It was under oath. It was subject to perjury. It was about incidents about the Clarence he had direct knowledge. So this wasn't some dubious hearsay report. It directly refuted what the government put in this case, and it's our position that the interest of justice, under the circumstances of this case, allowed its admission.
And is it your argument that you did not have the ability to introduce the same evidence through other available witnesses?
Oh, yes, because Andrew Wilson testified that Eusitis was alone in a room with him and brought out the black box and said things to him and tortured him. No other witness but Eusitis could refute that. Andrew Wilson testified that Detective Hill was in there assisting Burge with these things. Well, only Burge and Hill could testify to that. Burge, of course, did testify, but the jury had to be wondering, well, where are all these other officers? The witnesses we did call were more or less collateral. O'Hara, he oversaw Wilson the entire time. Other witnesses took the Fifth Amendment, so we couldn't call them anyways. But the principal actors in Wilson's testimony, we were not allowed to refute with prior sworn testimony that was cross-examined. And the fact that there was such robust cross-examination in this case is the distinguishing feature. And I see I've used all my time. So,
thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
I'm afraid I helped you do that.
It happens.
Barry?
Good morning. May it please the Court. April Perry on behalf of the United States of America. I'd like to begin with the official proceeding element where Mr. Martin began. In this case, the indictment properly pled and the government appropriately proved obstruction or attempted obstruction of an official proceeding. As Judge Rovner, Your Honor, mentioned, the basic words of the statute, and I agree with Mr. Martin on that at least, the basic words of the statute do not require that the defendant's conduct occur in a particular place or before a court. The only way that Mr. Martin gets the word before into the statute at all is by taking 1515's definitional section and then reading that into the middle of the statute. If the conduct had to occur in a particular place, that would be in the statute itself. You wouldn't have to reach out to a definitional section and then infer it in. And this is best showed by 1512C1. A statute that also has the official proceeding element in it. But of course, no one is arguing that 1512C1 requires that the obstructive conduct occur in the courtroom itself, and in fact, no case has so held. Similarly, no case has ever held that 1512C2 requires the obstructive conduct to occur in a particular place.
Now, the language of the obstruction statute casts a really broad net.
It does.
Do you agree? And a person can be criminally liable for corruptly obstructing, influencing, or impeding an official proceeding. Are there any limits to what this constitutes in the context of a civil suit? You know, so what about if a party intentionally delayed in responding to an interrogatory? Would that qualify as corruptly impeding an official proceeding?
It could, Judge, yes. There are two limiting factors on it, the first of which is that it has to be corruptly done. There are a lot of things that happen in the context of civil proceedings, delay, less than a full and complete answer in response to an interrogatory, that are not corruptly done, that are done through negligence or other forms of civil litigation. The corruptly is a limiting aspect on the statute. The other thing that limits the government is obviously that the intent needs to be to obstruct. The intent of the actor must be to somehow change the outcome of the proceeding. That also severely limits the amount of conduct in civil cases that can be charged. Of course, all of those things were present here, and because the statute itself and all of the applicable case law does not hold that the conduct must be occurring in court, we feel that both the indictment and the proof were sufficient on the 1512C2
You
argument.
Know, I'd like to really go on to that jury instruction, because although perhaps not rising to the level of a constructive amendment, would the government acknowledge that the jury instruction regarding materiality was confusing in that it seemed to allow a finding of materiality if an answer would lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, regardless of the significance of that evidence to the case?
I don't think so, no, Your Honor. And that's because of the words that follow, or otherwise affect its outcome.
The narrowing,
exactly
right. Talking about?
Or is not a disjunctive when it's or otherwise. Just like with 1512, which also speaks or otherwise, it is a way to describe one particular way in which the outcome could have been affected. This was designed to help explain Professor Michael's testimony. Professor Michael gave a very broad overview on civil procedure. and how interrogatory answers could be used in civil procedure, specifically to get admissible evidence as admissions at trial or in a motion for summary judgment. And one way that Professor Michael described was to get evidence that's admissible at trial, which in this case it was very clear that this evidence would have been very important to the plaintiff in the civil case. This was a lawsuit about torture and about the Chicago Police Department's policy and practices of torture. Defendant's interrogatory answer went to the very heart of Hobley's lawsuit. It was not confusing to the jurors that someone denying a policy and practice of torture and a decade of such torture would have an effect on Hobley's lawsuit that involved those very same issues. Because this was such, for lack of a better word, undisputed issue at trial, there was very little time spent on it in arguments because it was very clear, both to the jurors and to the parties at the time, that this would have been material. And one way it would have been material was because this evidence would have been very important to the plaintiff. Because of that, that instruction was simply trying to put the evidence in context for the jurors to understand in relation to the law. And that is something that the jury instructions are, of course, supposed to do, to help the jurors understand the evidence and then put it into the context of what the legal standard is. The outcome was what was important here. That is what the government always argued and understood it to be. And the defendant has presented no argument that the jury could have interpreted it any other way, that there was any other way that this lie would have affected the proceedings. For all of those reasons, it's not only not a constructive amendment, but the variance does not matter either. If there are no other questions, I will move on to the third issue that Mr. Martin argued, the district court's decision to exclude the prior testimony. And as Your Honor,
I did have another question. I was wondering how you would have us define materiality in the context of false answers to discovery.
Well, any answer that has a natural tendency to change the outcome would be material. That is the jury instruction that was given in this particular case, whether or not it had a natural tendency to change the outcome.
That's the entirety.
Correct. And in this case, it did have a natural tendency to change the outcome, both as an admission of a party or failure to admit something that had occurred, and also could have been useful for summary judgment. With respect to the prior testimony, the district court did not abuse its discretion in excluding the testimony of Officers Eusitis, McKenna, Hill, and O'Hara. First of all, the district court properly found that those witnesses had a tremendous motive to lie. Now, Mr. Martin argues that the jury should be sorting out all reliability issues, but that, of course, would make the rules of evidence completely superfluous. The point of the rules of evidence is to make sure that the jury is only hearing reliable evidence. Perry versus New Hampshire was a completely different issue. It was whether something that was already admissible under the rules of evidence also needed to undergo a reliability analysis. Here, not only was the evidence inadmissible under the rules of evidence, but the only rule that it possibly could have been admitted under, Rule 807, explicitly required the district court judge to consider the evidence's reliability. Here, the district court appropriately found that the evidence was not reliable.
Now, weren't there other witnesses who testified specifically at trial that Burge called, and these were witnesses who didn't invoke the Fifth Amendment?
Yes. There were a number of witnesses who impeached Wilson's testimony, and let me begin by saying Wilson himself was impeached. The cross-examination in this case was much more lengthy than the direct examination. So on top of the 185 pages of cross-examination of Wilson that was read to the jury, then the defense was able to call additional witnesses who impeached Wilson's testimony, specifically a state's attorney who is present at Area 2 on February 14th, the day of Wilson's interrogation, an officer who saw Wilson in the middle of the day and said he was not at all injured, and the court reporter who was present during all of the occasions when State's Attorney Hyman, one of the witnesses who the defendant complains he was not able to admit testimony for, the court reporter was there.
Fifth, didn't he?
He did take the fifth. And he has taken the Fifth in a previous proceeding, which is another reason that the government has argued that his testimony was unreliable, and he has been found unreliable at a prior proceeding. So there were a number of other witnesses who were able to impeach Wilson. And Wilson himself, despite the defendant's argument, was not all that persuasive of a witness. Let's remember, it was being read by an agent who did not have any emotion in his voice and was not otherwise able to convey what had happened to him in the same way that Wilson was. Testimony being read into the record is not all that persuasive. What Wilson was important for is all of the uncontradicted witnesses who the government presented and the uncontroverted evidence the government presented that Wilson was indeed abused at Area 2. The defendant has acknowledged that Wilson was injured while in police custody. The defendant simply wants to blame other officers who took custody of them of Wilson later. But of course, it's important to remember that every single officer who had any contact with Wilson on February 14th has denied having any involvement in Wilson's injuries. So then the question becomes, when did Wilson get injured? And that's where this case was especially important and where the other evidence, the witnesses who Wilson talked to afterwards, the nurse and the doctor who examined Wilson, the photographs of Wilson's injuries, all of those were especially important, and none of these particular witnesses that were not able to testify would have had any bearing on that independent evidence of Wilson's abuse. Mr. Martin mentioned that Eusitis was alone in a room with Wilson, and in that particular way, no one was able to contradict Wilson's testimony. That may be true, but first of all, Your Honors, whatever Eusitis did while alone with Wilson was not relevant to this particular trial. The trial involved whether the defendant tortured Wilson or knew about that torture. So whether or not Eusitis did particular things while alone with Wilson was not an issue that really even mattered. Whether or not Eusitis was guilty was not the question before this particular jury. And secondly, there were a number of other witnesses who impeached Wilson, and further impeachment would simply not have made any difference in this case. If the panel has no further questions, the government would simply ask that the conviction and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. You saved 5 minutes for rebuttal, which your time ran out on that, but I'll give you 2 more minutes to finish.
I think the government's recitation of all the evidence regarding Wilson shows why it was not just a passing mention at trial and why, if there was error, it was not harmless error.
Of course, there were four other victims of abuse that were totally separate from Wilson. So just looking at harmless error analysis, even if that was an error by the district court, given the other evidence, It was harmless, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor, because the government opposed our unanimity instruction that we submitted with respect to each one of the interrogations, and they argued to the jury both in opening and closing that we only have to prove one, and the focus was Wilson. I mean, we've laid out in the briefs the number of witnesses and all the evidence, so it was demonstrably different than these other interrogations. They did produce evidence. Some of them, Mr. Burge was not alleged to have been the interrogator, so that's our argument with respect to that. The government says a testimony read into the record is not all that persuasive. Well, being on the receiving end of that testimony, I beg to differ, because the jury's deprived of the opportunity to evaluate the demeanor of the witness, in this case, Mr. Wilson. On the materiality argument, we did contest materiality. We did have a theory on materiality that because this was supposedly material to a Monell claim, the government would first have to prove that Hobley suffered some constitutional injury, which it didn't take on that proof in this case or call Hobley. And the government objected every time we attempted to do that, and the district court disallowed that type of evidence. So materiality was an issue in this case. We did not concede it in any way.
And so I just want to get back to this harmless error, though. When you look at the testimony, of the various witnesses with respect to some of these victims, like Shadid, Mumin, the tightening of handcuffs, the Russian roulette gun, the suffocation with the plastic typewriter cover bag, where you had a detective who was under immunity who testified, and then with respect to Banks, the officer testified that he saw injuries that Banks received after the interrogation. His lawyer and the examining doctor testified that he told him he'd been beaten, and medical records were consistent with Banks' accounts of the injuries. All I'm saying is that was pretty powerful evidence as well.
And, Your Honor, I'm out of time, but I think
take time to answer Judge Williams' question, then you can wrap up.
Thank you. With respect to Banks, Mr. Burge was not alleged to have been the interrogator, and so that wasn't he didn't participate in that one. And in all of these other incidents, we had significant impeachment and rebuttal. Mumin, he never made an allegation around the time. He didn't even know who Burge was when questioned years after the fact. And we lay it out in the briefs, and it would take too much time to explain here, but that was all hotly contested. And when you take that on top of the fact that the jury didn't have to find on any of those, it was just had to find one, we don't know what the jury found. And here Wilson was the focal point of the case. And I appreciate the extra time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thanks to both counsel for a very good job. The case will be taken under advisement.